This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm your host this week, Nathan Sanders. We are starting a two-part look back at Texas and Abilene over the last 250 years. First up, we look all the way back to what was happening in this part of the continent at the time that the Founding Fathers were declaring independence from Great Britain. KACU's Heather Claiborne spoke with Don Frazier. He's the director of the Texas Center at Shriner University in Kerrville.
Don, thank you for joining us to explore what was happening here at the founding of the nation. Let me say we only have a few minutes to refresh our memory on a place and period that fills hundreds of lengthy books. So thank you for being willing to share your expertise.
I'm glad to be back on KACU, tell you the truth. So thanks for asking me.
Well, welcome. In 1776, 56 delegates put their names on the Declaration of Independence. The 13 established colonies became the United States of America. But what was going on here in what eventually became Texas in the 1770s?
Well, it was still a howling wilderness. So it was in the process of becoming, but it was not very far down that road, to tell you the truth. Right there in Abilene, it was a struggle between the newly arrived Comanches and the Apaches that had already moved into the area a few decades before and displaced the people that lived there before them. So there was a chain of events going on in West Texas that would ultimately decide who would be the dominant power out there. The only non-indigenous, non-Indian settlements in Texas were really down along the San Antonio and Guadalupe River valleys below the Balcones Escarpment. And that's where we have our first cattle ranches, and they're really settled around the missions that were founded there. There had been an attempt to settle in East Texas, but those people had been recalled back to San Antonio. There was an attempt to make a Spanish Presidio and Mission Complex in present-day Menard, but it had ended poorly as well. There had been some Indian violence there and a military campaign that went all the way to the Red River, but other than that, it was a tough, tough country.
And was it officially under Spanish control at that point?
It was. It was the far-flung northern Spanish frontera, and was technically part of the provincias internas, or the internal provinces. So think of it as almost the Spanish outback in North America. It was really not much of a place in terms of Spanish occupation.
Well, speaking of place, when you look at a map, Texas has such a distinctive shape. When did the lines that define the state first emerge, and who was responsible for them?
Thing about Texas is nobody quite knew where the corners of that ranch were. So the Spanish just kind of had a spot on the map and said, this is kind of Texas, and this is kind of New Mexico, and this is kind of all these other provinces to the south. And so Texas doesn't get its interesting sort of throwing star shape until 1850, actually. That's when finally the boundaries of Texas are locked down in stone after it's annexed to the United States in 1845, 46, depends on how you count it. And that's when El Paso becomes that little sticky out part to the west, is in 1850. And this is all done as part of the legislation that became known as the Compromise of 1850.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Native Americans in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. You mentioned the Apaches and the Comanches. Give us just a really broad overview of that moment and the effort to control this land by the Native Americans.
People don't realize that there were really no Comanches before 1705. Remember that most Native peoples, we call them by the name that the Europeans gave them. If you asked them what they called themselves, for instance, the Comanches, it was Numina, which in Comanche means the people, the human beings. They get the name Comanche because somebody else said, those people over there are the ones who want to fight us all the time. And in that language was Comanche. So it's an interesting sort of mind exercise to figure out who these people were, based on what they called themselves and what other people called them. Apache, or Apaches, That's a Pueblo word for the people that are always coming around and meaning us harm. So that's not even the name they called themselves. But for argument's sake, we've got Comanches and we've got Apaches. And by 1776, they are trying to figure out who's going to be the boss in West Texas. And Apaches are coming out on the short end of that stick. And they've been really fragmented. The Lipan Apaches are heading down into southern Texas and northern Coahuila. Other Apaches that become the Mescalero and Chiricahua and others are being pushed into the western mountains of what is today New Mexico and Arizona. There is a cataclysmic battle, and no one's quite sure exactly where this happens, but it's somewhere northwest of Abilene up towards the Panhandle that really breaks Apache power once and for all in that part of Texas and really begins that fragmentation process. And the Comanches fill that void and they start pushing deep into Texas and even deep into northern Mexico.
And Mexico did hold power over this region for some time. And what did the Mexican government see the value of adding Texas to its territory was? What did they want from holding Texas?
So Spain operated Texas as part of its interior provinces, but they had a native problem. The Comanches were starting to raid into the better parts of Mexico, the richer parts. So Spain's solution was to buy them off. They would have a gathering once a year, and they would just pay the Comanches to not bug them. And that seemed to work. They had trade going on. It's a complicated relationship, but of course, Spain is no longer in power by 1821. They've left and they've been replaced by the newly independent Mexico, Republic of Mexico, after 1824. So Mexico inherits Texas. It didn't necessarily go and take it from anybody. It's just part of the legacy of the Spanish Empire that Mexico gets to deal with. Well, in the process of becoming an independent nation, some of that revolutionary violence had spilled over into Texas, and one out of two people were killed or driven off. I'm talking about the settlers. So all of a sudden, Mexico has this largely depopulated province that is really at the mercy of the Comanches. And they've got to fix it somehow. And they come up with the solution. Why don't we invite people to settle Texas? And we need some people that can turn Texas into something that'll be productive and prosperous. And that's actually what kicks off the impresario period that we're all familiar with Stephen F. Austin and that bunch.
So that was around the 1820s, that same time period. And what was it that drew people to this part of the frontier when the Anglo-Americans started to make their way into Texas? What was it that, I mean, that was a pretty rough country, it sounds like. So why did they want to be here?
They wanted to be there because there was a huge financial panic in the United States in 1819. So thank Great Depression, just a earlier version. And so there was a lot of people that were that had gone bankrupt. They were looking for some way to keep body and soul together. And the new Republic of Mexico said, if you'll just come out to this very rugged country and turn it into something that's useful and productive, we'll give you 4,000 acres of land that'll be all yours. And for somebody who's impoverished in northern Alabama or western Kentucky or Tennessee, that sounds like an awfully good deal.
And some of that financial promise were the cattle that gave us a chance here in Texas to be part of a new industry to some extent, right?
Well, that's the thing that was interesting about the Mexican land grants to the American colonists that were coming in and becoming Tejanos themselves. The land grants that they were given included enough acreage for you to cultivate for a cash crop and also enough pasturage that you could raise beef or cattle or, I mean, beef cattle or horses or any other livestock. So it was really a mixed-use agricultural setup that you were being given by the government of Mexico, and cattle thrived in Texas. The Spanish had already introduced the cattle industry up and down the San Antonio and Guadalupe River valleys. In fact, it was cattle from those valleys that had been driven in the late 1770s, early 1780s, into Louisiana and supported Spanish troops that were fighting on behalf of the United States during the War for Independence. So Texas was a proven cattle country, and people moving from the American South and elsewhere in the United States understood that. And they had a cattle culture of their own that they were introducing here that ended up sort of hybridizing with the Spanish cattle industry that was already here.
And how important was the cattle industry to the founding of West Texas and the big country?
There's a poem by Berta Hart Nance, which is one of my favorites. And the poem has a line in it that says, you know, other states are carved and born. Texas was made from hide and horn. And that is certainly the case in West Texas. You know, one of the things that West Texas has over any other part of the state is miles and miles of miles and miles. And it was all grassland, and it was all going to be perfect pasturage. Comanches figured that out first. And so when people start moving into Texas, especially after the American Civil War, they saw this as a great opportunity to rebuild their fortunes, which may have been absolutely destroyed in the aftermath of the fighting back east. So that's when West Texas really comes into its own, is in 17, the 1870s, the 1880s, 1890s. And that's when the great cattle kingdoms and the great ranches of West Texas really take root and flourish.
Well, we're going to pick that story up next week when we talk to Jay Moore. Don Fraser, thank you so much for taking the time to look back at the history of Texas with us today.
Always glad to be with you. Thank you.
That's KACU's Heather Claiborne speaking with Don Fraser, director of the Texas Center at Shriner University in Kerrville. Tune in next week when we pick up the story with the timeline of Abilene's founding and growth. This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm Nathan Sanders. Lots of Americans will be firing up their grills this weekend, but there may be a little more variety, like more chicken or hot dogs, as home barbecue chefs look for ways to trim their grocery budgets. Beef prices at the grocery store are already high, and they could rise another 10% by the end of the year, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The Texas Standard's Michael Marks reports that the country's small cattle population is helping push those prices up.
The U.S. cattle herd is at its smallest since 1951, according to the USDA. That's a big reason why ground beef hit a record $6.89 per pound earlier this year. The cattle population has gone down for six straight years, and industry watchers like Daryl Peel say it could keep shrinking.
We still don't know for sure that we actually have a low in place yet that would allow us then to turn around.
Peel is an extension livestock marketing specialist at Oklahoma State University. He says that the U.S. cattle herd generally expands and contracts in a predictable cycle. When there are few cattle available, like right now, ranchers can profit.
We've got essentially record high prices for cattle and for beef right now.
Those high prices normally incentivize ranchers to grow their herds. We are not seeing that happen.
But I think there's some good reasons we're not.
David Anderson is a professor and extension livestock economist at Texas A&M University.
One is, you know, we continue to have drought problems around the country where we produce cows. So that's a problem. It just prevents you from growing.
Steady rains throughout much of Texas this spring have helped, but a lot of cattle country is still stressed from long-term drought. Again, here's Daryl Peel of Oklahoma State.
Starting in about 2021, really late 2020, up until even current times, we've had lots of drought conditions pretty much all over the country at some point in time. And so that forced producers to do more liquidation than they planned, than they would have because of the normal cattle cycle.
Lack of available water can force producers to sell animals. Year after year of drought also has a compounding effect on pastures. They grow less grass, so ranchers can't stock them with as many cattle.
I've had to shrink my own cow herd to adjust to the feed that's available.
That's Kevin Buse of Hereford in the Panhandle. He's a rancher and the CEO of Champion Feeders, which buys cattle from ranchers, then sells them to meat packers after the animals gain weight. Although ranchers are benefiting from the high price of cattle, it's causing headaches for feedlot owners like Buse and for meat packers, which process the animal and package its beef.
I'm very concerned about where we're at with regards to packers shuttering plants. It's an extremely big deal.
The scarcity of cattle has cut into their bottom line. This year, meatpacking plants in Nebraska, Texas, Pennsylvania, and Tennessee have closed or reduced operating hours. The presence of the New World screwworm has made the problem worse. To try to prevent the pest spreading north from Mexico, the USDA suspended the trade of livestock across the border in May of 2025.
You know, with us closing the Mexican border, that shut out a million to 1.3 million head a year for us in the Texas Panhandle. That's caused considerable amount of adjusting.
If more packing facilities close from year after year of scarce cattle, that could drive beef prices up even higher. Peel thinks that's possible in the near future.
At this point in time, particularly with very little prospects that cattle inventories are going to grow anytime soon, I would not be surprised to see some additional adjustments as we go forward. It's never clear exactly, you know, who would do that or where or how, but it's certainly a distinct possibility.
People are still buying as much beef as they ever have, though, even with the high prices. Economists are monitoring whether that stays true as the cost continues to rise. I'm Michael Marks.
With the 4th of July just days away, many people in the big country are preparing to celebrate with fireworks. This hasn't been a given in recent years. After the public celebration ended in a grass fire a couple of years ago, and officials canceled last year's fireworks show after instituting a burn ban days before the holiday. This year, there's no burn ban in place, but as KACU's Allison McCall reports, fire officials are encouraging residents to celebrate responsibly.
For just a few days every summer, fireworks light up the usually dark West Texas sky. Across the big country, families gather in parks, backyards, and at cookouts and community events to celebrate Independence Day. Nikki, who asked that we just use her first name, has watched the trends for years. Manning the fireworks booth has become part of her family's annual observation of Independence Day.
This is our 12th year that we've been selling fireworks for TNT. We enjoy coming out here and doing this with our family. Our youngest was a baby when we started this, so she's grown up doing this, and it's just been a lot of fun. It's a family tradition every year.
In West Texas, the hot, dry weather can disrupt celebrations. Last year, Taylor County Commissioners instituted a burn ban on July 1st, prompting officials to cancel Abilene's official fireworks show. This year, local firework retailers like Nikki say that they've seen an increase in sales.
They've actually been better this year. People are buying more than what they have historically during the first week of the season.
And Nikki says large aerial fireworks have been most popular this year. This could be sparked by the historic milestone of this year's holiday, the Freedom 250 official fireworks show on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. aims to break the Guinness World Record by setting off more than 850,000 fireworks. Closer to home, two shows are scheduled in Abilene on Saturday night, one on Stamford Street and the other at Abilene's Freedom Festival at the Taylor County Expo Center. All of the glittery explosions are not without risk. In 2025, drones malfunctioned at the end of Abilene's show, sending them crashing to the ground and igniting a grass fire. Taylor County is not currently under a burn ban, but Abilene Fire Department Public Information Officer, firefighter Lindsay Fletcher, notes that Saturday's forecast calls for highs near 100 degrees with breezy conditions.
It's hot and it's dry. We know even if we tell people not to shoot off fireworks, they're still going to do it. But I just want to give y'all some tips on how to keep your house safe, maybe, for people who are doing that.
Local laws ban residents from setting off pyrotechnics inside Abilene city limits. Officials urge residents heading to unincorporated areas for their personal fireworks celebrations to use a little extra caution, even before their first firework is lit.
keep your gutters cleaned of like any dry leaves or any debris in your house. Make sure the area around your house is also clear of that same stuff, flammable things, just so that if there are any errant sparks or errant fireworks that come down on your property, it doesn't have a lot to catch.
But safety doesn't end when the fireworks stop. Fletcher says one of the biggest mistakes people make is assuming used fireworks are no longer dangerous. They can stay hot long after the show is over, making proper disposal just as important as preparation.
Like, you need to have a bucket of water, you need to have a water hose somewhere to make sure all of your old fireworks are like really out and really soaked, make sure they're not still burning.
Retailers like Nikki are also encouraging their shoppers to celebrate responsibly.
Be careful in windy conditions. Make sure that you have some source of water or something close by just in case a fire were to happen. And use safety. Make sure your fireworks are set on level ground. Don't put them in rocky or bumpy or holy areas. Try to have it on level ground.
West Texans always need to be careful not to ignite a grass fire with their fireworks. But the combination of gunpowder and carelessness also poses a danger for people. The U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission estimates that fireworks caused 13,000 injuries last year, with 15 to 24-year-olds accounting for the largest share of the reported injuries. Lindsay Fletcher says first responders hope to have fewer calls to respond to this year.
Just stay safe. Like, you want it to be fun, and you want it to stay fun. You don't want to have to interrupt your night by calling 911 or going to the hospital.
And it's not just the Roman candles sending people to the ER. Officials say more than 1,300 injuries involved sparklers last year. While many people think of them as a safer option for children, they can burn at temperatures hot enough to cause serious injuries. Officials urge parents to keep an eye on children with sparklers in order to keep America's 250th celebration from ending in tears. I'm Allison McCall in Abilene.
This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm Nathan Sanders. The New World screwworm is back in Texas. Agricultural leaders warn these parasitic flies could harm pets and ravage the state's cattle industry. But Texas has been through this before, not just with screwworms, but with lots of invasive species. KUT's Katie McAfee has a story of how scientists reined in one pest that many people might not realize once posed a threat.
It was the early 1990s. Research scientist Rob Plows was driving a rental van down I-35. He had precious cargo in the back seat, plastic trays filled with hundreds of thousands of red imported fire ants.
And suddenly I put my hand the back of my neck and I realized that all the fire ants had escaped out of the trays and they were all swarming on the inside of the truck.
Plows had made this trip many times before, and he had a contingency plan for this sort of thing. If there was a small escape, he'd use a little bit of ethanol to kill any ants that got out. Only, this wasn't a small escape. He had to douse the whole van.
The problem was that after 5 minutes of spraying with alcohol, I had consumed more alcohol than the ants had. So I had to sleep at the side of the road until I felt good enough to be able to drive back.
He took it easy for a few hours and then cleaned the van out as best he could. But fire ants are extremely hard to get rid of. So when it was time to return the van to the rental place,
the guy came out to have a look and check the mileage and everything. And there were still ants just pouring out of the air vents and things.
Did you get in trouble with the rental company?
No, I don't know much about this.
Plows may have caused a fire ant infestation, but he was actually trying to prevent them. He was one of the few scientists at UT Austin's Breckenridge Field Laboratory working to eradicate them in the 80s and 90s. Because fire ants might seem as Texan as two-step, but they're actually invasive. They first arrived on a ship from South America to Mobile, Alabama in the 1930s. Back then, sailors used dirt to keep ships balanced when they were traveling without cargo. When they unloaded the dirt, they unknowingly deposited hundreds, maybe thousands, of what would later be named the red imported fire ant onto and into American soil. From there, they began a relentless migration across the American South. Within a few decades, they made it to Texas, much to the chagrin of ranchers, homeowners, and anyone walking barefoot.
A tiny ant called the fire ant, because of its sickening sting, has become a big problem for Texans, and it may be unstoppable.
At that point in the 1980s, fire ants were a big thing in the news. People running for Texas Ag Commissioner on a platform of let's eradicate fire ants.
That's Larry Gilbert, a professor of integrative biology at UT. He says in South America, fire ants evolved alongside natural predators to keep them in check. But they had no natural enemies in the U.S., so they spread across Texas like syrup on a plate, killing baby cattle, spoiling crops, and shorting out electrical equipment.
And not to mention the fact that a certain fraction of the population are just deathly allergic to fire ants.
A very small fraction, less than 0.1%, according to the National Library of Medicine. But the threat was enough for Texas leaders to wage war against fire ants. They set up quarantine sites. They encouraged residents to douse fire ant mounds with insecticides and report sightings to their county health department. Fire ants became a huge economic problem, too. Texas spent more than $1 billion a year fighting them, according to one estimate. None of it was working. Gilbert says it felt like you could walk across Texas on fire ant mounds, a genetic mutation that researchers believe occurred after red-imported fire ants came to the U.S. made them particularly hard to eradicate.
We had a form of the fire ant, which is the multiple queen form, where you can have as many as 100 queens or more in a colony. And so now the workers, instead of executing the extra queens like the British used to do, they tolerate them.
These queens are constantly reproducing, laying over 1,000 eggs a day in some cases. The population spread too fast to be tamed with chemicals. Even if the pesticides worked, Gilbert says it wouldn't have been a long-term solution. They caused too much harm to the rest of the ecosystem. Some of them were banned in the late 80s for being carcinogenic. Gilbert wanted to find a sustainable solution, one that worked with the ecosystem instead of against it.
And so the next step was, let's go to South America and see why these things aren't considered a pest there.
In the early 90s, Gilbert got on a plane to Brazil with Plows, the rental van guy, and a few other researchers. In the Brazilian countryside, they noticed something peculiar. Fire ants were still one of the dominant ants in the ecosystem.
But in a field the size of a football field, you might have 5 or 6 species of these little flies that attack the fire ants and cause great chaos.
The great chaos goes like this. A tiny fly swoops in, injects an egg into a fire ant, paralyzes it, and flies away. The egg hatches, and the larva eventually burrows into the ant's head. The ant's head falls off, and it dies. The flies don't just kill fire ants. They also make it more difficult for them to forage for food. Gilbert says the discovery was one of the first promising biological controls for the fire ant, and they had to take advantage of it. His team brought back several species of the flies to Austin. It took decades, but he says,
we've naturalized about 4 species of these flies in Texas, and most places you go, like if you go out here and kick a mound, you'll get 2 different species of the flies coming to attack the ants.
Gilbert can't say for sure if his research helped reduce the fire ant population in Texas, but he's pretty convinced.
We get congratulations from ranchers saying, wow, you know, since the flies got here, I'm seeing more quail, or I'm starting to see lizards, I'm starting to see this and that.
He says fire ants aren't ravaging the state like they used to, but they'll never be fully eradicated from Texas. Attention has been turned to newer invasive pests. African grasses, the cactus moth, the New World screwworm. The only thing left to do is watch where you step. I'm Katie McAfee in Austin.
It's time for West Texas Roots. Back in the day, it wasn't uncommon to use dynamite rather than heavy-duty machinery to dig up rock. However, it came with its dangers. Philip Compton recalls how he got his fair share of splinters from a dynamite job and why he began using Kubota 4x4s rather than horses while working on his land.
One time I was using this dynamite to blast this tree out of the fence row because I didn't have any other way to get rid of it. And lo and behold, I put a couple of sticks of dynamite under it, and I backed off a little bit, and as I was backing off, it went off. And my wife, what has been 40 years ago, still has found splinters in my back. I guess they just stayed there forever. She still found one just recently. And this, oh, we're talking about this was in the 70s. Nowadays, you can't buy that to save your life. There's no way you can find anybody. And I don't blame them. I wouldn't want to sell dynamite. I was a 16-year-old kid the day I went and picked up this dynamite in the CB radio days. And when I got down to Higginbotham's and Coleman to get it, they said, now put the dynamite in the back of your pickup and the blasting caps in the front and don't use any radios. Of course, a 16-year-old kid, I'd want to listen to music and get on the CB radio and everything, but they said, don't you dare do that. So anyway, it all worked out good. I got home all right. And we used to use it to blast like stock tanks. In our area, you go down 4 feet and you hit a solid layer of sediment rocks. And the key, of course, to have longevity of the tanks is to, hold more water and hold it longer is to go deeper. So we would drill down through the rock and put dynamite in it, and we'd back off, 100 yards or so at least, and we'd set that thing off, and boy, the rock would go everywhere, Then we'd use a bulldozer to finish ripping it out and cleaning it out. But that's the main reason why we use dynamite. For many years, we rode horses, and we'd ride out, which whenever I was young, there was nothing better than riding out through a pasture on a horse, checking fences, checking cattle, checking wildlife, anything. You know, the worst thing to have is a covey of quail jump up right in front of you or a turkey off a nest. I've had a lot of tumbleweed scare the devil out of horses. You'd think that they'd be used to it, but they're concentrating on working and they're not focusing on what they're going to step on, like a rattlesnake. Sometimes a rattlesnake will scare the devil out of a horse, but sometimes you just walk right on by. But I don't ride anymore. I rode about 40 years, and like I say, my last horse died and I didn't even bother replacing it. Well, now we ride around side by side. That's how we operate now. And it is so much easier. They don't eat all the time. They only eat when you turn the key. So in other words, they're the best things to have. So anyway, that's how we operate. We don't even like drive around in our pickups. All of our roads are mostly just for Kubotas. We go everywhere. Anyway, that's all I've ever done all my whole life is work out there on that place. Places, but around here we've got acreage here, acreage there, or acreage over there. It's not like one big outfit in one place. Daddy called me I was a kid like a bull in a china closet. I would I tore up, not intentionally, it just happened because that's how you learn. You do this, do that, and sometimes you mess up. But the worst thing I ever did one time is I backed up in a barn with my door open, and the door went. We've all done that. So it's not without blemishes. There's always something going to happen out there. But I believe in learning it hands-on. I read a little bit, but my daddy called it School of Hard Knocks, trial and error. Try it and see what happens. And that's how we've kind of operated our business is, we'll try this, try that. If something works, we stay with it. If it doesn't, we get away from it.
We recorded Philip Compton's story of ranching in West Texas at the Taylor County Expo Center. This is the West Texas Dispatch. Fireworks aren't the only thing families are looking forward to this 4th of July. For many, apple pie is just as valuable to their traditions as the sparklers and hot dogs. Why does this classic American dessert remain a holiday favorite? KACU's Allison Diaz spoke with local bakers to find out.
As America prepares to celebrate its 250th birthday this 4th of July, bakeries are preparing for one of the busiest holidays of the summer.
I'm so excited about the 250th anniversary of it. Pie is just an all-American thing.
Leslie Bivens is the co-owner of Life of Pie in Abilene. Her bakery produces apple pies with the classic lattice topping. But Bivens says that's not the only option for patriotic Americans wanting to taste the sweetness of this iconic pie.
The crumble one is my favorite just because it actually tastes almost like a strudel, so it's a brown sugar crumble. It's just amazing. Warmed up about 15, 20 seconds, scoop up ice cream, perfect for a hot 4th of July day.
And it's just the thing that a lot of Americans want to reach for as they celebrate Independence Day. The phrase, as American as apple pie, stretches back generations. It is deeply woven into American culture. Why apple pie? Even Caitlin Wallace, owner of Katie Pies in Abilene, isn't sure how apple pie became tied to American patriotism.
I don't know how it came around to being the American thing. I don't know. It's just a very traditional American food. I don't know. Apple pie has been around forever and ever, and apples have always been super plentiful forever and ever. So it makes sense that we would grow our desserts. apple pie has always been popular because who doesn't love an apple pie?
The history behind why the apple pie became tied to America started when European colonizers brought the different types of apple seeds over to the U.S. This developed more variety of apples suitable for baking, much better than the sour crab apples native to North America. The apple pie was first featured in an American cookbook in 1796 and was later linked to American patriotism in World War II when soldiers were asked what they were fighting for, and the soldiers famously said, "Mom, an apple pie." Later in the 1970s, the famous jingle, "Baseball, Hot Dogs, Apple Pie, and Chevrolet," reinforced apple pie's place as an American icon. Generations of Americans handed down recipes and techniques for creating the perfect apple pie. Grandmothers showed their grandchildren how to roll a pie dough to the perfect thickness with the family's wooden rolling pin. Caitlin Wallace still uses this traditional method by spreading a layer of flour over her work table and hand rolling out the dough. She then puts it through the automatic dough sheeter machine that many commercial bakeries use. The machine is not only quicker, the dough comes out thinner and more uniform. Wallace cuts the dough sheet into strips and hand weaves the signature lattice top that has completed American apple pies for generations. For home bakers and professional pie makers, craftsmanship is key. Caitlin Wallace does not skimp on the process or the ingredients.
Everything is 100% scratch. We made the dough, we cut all the apples, we cooked them, everything. The correct mix of apples. During the fall, Macintosh are like the best to use. They're like my favorite pie apple. But when Macintosh aren't in season, I have to find like a tart and a sweet apple to kind of mix together to make kind of the same effect. Lots of butter and sugar, cinnamon, nutmeg, all that good stuff goes into it.
Wallace is often recognized for her hand pies, but her full-size pies carry more than flavor. Her apple pie recipe is a family heirloom that's been handed down from generation to generation.
The apple pie, this is actually literally the first pie I ever learned to make. It was like my mom's recipe. It was on this like withered yellow paper recipe book. Yeah, so it was the first pie recipe I ever did.
Every family has their unique ingredient. Whether it's the mix of apples, a special mix of spices, or using ice water or lard or vodka in the crust. And the Independence Day holiday gives families the perfect time to share those sweet traditions as they celebrate the birth of this nation. I'm Allison Diaz in Abilene.
Our friends at the Texas Standard have been collecting the 250 top moments in Texas music. Songs from, by, and about Texas. Here's this week's installment of the series.
I'm Matt Riley from KUTX, and as we look towards the 250th birthday of the United States, we're celebrating with the Texas 250, the Lone Star State's contribution to American music. Here's a moment when Texas music had the world's attention. April 1972. The restrictions and conservatism of the Nashville record labels and recording houses made Willie Nelson decide he'd had enough. So he left Music City and returned to his home state, landing in Austin. The burgeoning hippie music scene at venues like the Armadillo World Headquarters reinvigorated Willie. His popularity in Austin soared as he honed his own unique sound, and he was eager to play live gigs in Texas without violating his 26-week residency requirement for the Grand Ole Opry. This move also spurred Willie to get out of his confining record contract with RCA, subsequently signing a much more lucrative deal with Columbia that granted him artistic freedom. His friend Waylon Jennings would soon follow suit, and thus began the Outlaw Country Movement. The Outlaw Country Movement was a rebellion against the formulaic and polished Nashville sound. The artists were now free to experiment with different styles and song structures, mixing in rock, jazz, and folk. Contemporaries Johnny Cash and Kris Kristofferson would soon be among their ranks, and a new breed of country music took the nation by storm. In 1976, Wanted, The Outlaws, the compilation album by Waylon Jennings, Willie Nelson, Jesse Coulter, and Tom Paul Glaser, was the first country album to go platinum. Outlaw country was here to stay. The legacy lives on today with artists like Sturgill Simpson, Miranda Lambert, and Chris Stapleton. All it took was for Willie to move to Austin. You can see more about this moment at texasstandard.org/texas250. And we want to hear from you. We're counting down the 250 essential Texas songs July 3rd and 4th on KUTX, and you can cast your vote for your favorite Texas song at texasstandard.org/texas250.
This has been the West Texas Dispatch. Thanks for tuning in. We're here each Wednesday at noon. Plan to join us and tell a friend. And if your friend isn't able to tune in Wednesdays at noon, let them know they can subscribe to the podcast. West Texas Dispatch is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can also find it on the KACU mobile app. We had help this week from our executive producer, Heather Claiborne, and producers Shayla Conley and Caleb Leger. Calvin Claiborne is our digital editor. Special thanks to JC Gamble, who wrote our theme. I'm Nathan Sanders.